been part of the attack on one of the planes that went into the World Trade Center and Pentagon. We'll also be hearing from a peace vigil that took place this weekend in New York. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland at WBIX.org, our spiritual and technical director. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers. We're broadcasting on Channel 34 in Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and our camera person is Karen Renucci. Thank you to the Pacifica stations, especially KPFA and Case FCF in Fresno, and of course, all of our affiliate stations around the country. We are Pacifica. Encourage your Pacifica station to tune in to Democracy Now! in Exile. You can also hear us at www.webactive.com. We're broadcasting from downtown community television. We're in the historic firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown, in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
You asked me why. I just went on tour. You asked me why. I just went on tour. You asked me why.
This is KPFA or KPFB, Berkeley or KFCF Fresno. We'll continue with the two-hour edition of Democracy Now! And also tell you to stay tuned at 11 o'clock. Kutai Darren Kwai will be here, and he'll take us from 11 to noon and play some music and talk about what is going on from his perspective. And we invite you to stay with KPFA as much as you can.
The Alameda Multicultural Community Center celebrates our fourth annual Multicultural Festival, Embracing Diversity, on Saturday, September 22nd from 11 to 5 p.m. at the College of Alameda. This benefit will include live music from Zydeco Flames, Tamas Ga, and many others, cultural dances from Mexico, Afghanistan, and Native American traditions, plus great food, arts and crafts booths, and children's activities. For more information, call 510-521-9405.
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! in Exile.
Without exception, we are horrified at the pain, fear, and death inflicted on thousands of people in New York and elsewhere by these acts. We are deeply concerned about the social and political aftermath of this event. We fear an upsurge of anti-Arab, anti-Muslim racism, and we have already seen the signs in the media and in conversations on the street.
As the world continues to mourn thousands killed in last week's World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks, they also plead for peace. We'll go to the vigils of New York and to journalist Robert Fisk in Lebanon, longtime Middle East correspondent, about his interview with Osama bin Laden. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! in Exile. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile Resistance Radio, broadcasting just blocks from where thousands of emergency workers continue to comb through the rubble of what once was the World Trade Center. Bush administration officials said yesterday they're considering lifting a 25-year-old ban on U.S. involvement in foreign assassinations and loosening restrictions on FBI surveillance. They said the Justice Department plans to send a wide-ranging set of proposals to Capitol Capitol Hill this week that would include more power to conduct wiretaps, detain foreigners, and track money laundering cases. Vice President Cheney said yesterday that CIA field officers may be allowed to recruit and pay overseas agents linked to terrorist groups and human rights abuses, saying it's necessary to infiltrate suspected terrorist cells. In addition, Florida Democratic Senator Bob Graham, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, says he'll introduce a counterterrorism package next week that'll create a counterterrorism czar inside the White House and establish authority for the CIA to recruit unsavory agents. And Secretary of State Colin Powell says the administration is reviewing an executive order issued by President Gerald Ford in 1976 that bans U.S. personnel from engaging in or conspiring to engage in assassinations. Some intelligence and terrorism experts have advocated assassinating Osama bin Laden. The exiled Saudi millionaire who lives in hiding in Afghanistan has been named the prime suspect in last week's attacks. The Senate last week approved legislation that would make it easier for the FBI to get warrants for electronic surveillance of computer transmissions. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Patrick Leahy, a Vermont Democrat, called the measure overly broad and an encroachment on civil liberties. He said, quote, "We have to be careful that in our horror and revulsion over this horrendous and terrible act, we don't start giving away the freedoms that make us different from terrorists." Several Democrats said many senators did not know exactly what they were voting on and supported the measure in their determination to condemn terrorism. European support for U.S.-led retaliation to last week's attacks in New York and Washington has shown signs of faltering as leaders strike a range of nuanced positions, some at odds with Washington's. Although the European Union foreign policy chief, Javier Solana, called for a grand international coalition to fight against this plague of terrorism, leading politicians in France, Germany, and Italy express reservations about the U.S. response, though German leaders are themselves divided. The term war is inappropriate, said Italian Defense Minister Antonio Martino, echoing views expressed across Italy's spectrum. Germany's president, Johannes Rau, doubted that his country's troops would take part in any armed response, suggesting they would play a role in providing logistical support to NATO's response. Russian defense officials have also qualified their initial signs of solidarity with the U.S. regarding military action. The defense minister ruled out launching attacks on Afghanistan from bordering former Soviet republics, and the chief of staff said Russia would not participate militarily. Spain, led like the U.S. by a right-wing administration, has given one of the strongest signals of support. This just in, an Afghani taxi driver was left paralyzed after a racist attack in London. And four people are now being held as, quote, material witnesses as the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation continues its huge investigation into Tuesday's attacks. Details of the latest arrests are not clear, but it's understood they relate specifically to the attack on the World Trade Center in New York. In addition to the arrest, 25 other people have been taken into custody on alleged immigration violations. The FBI has about 4,000 agents working on 40,000 leads. Racist attacks against Arabs or people of Arabic descent have increased around the world. In addition to the Afghan taxi driver being reported by BBC to have been paralyzed after an attack in London, over the last few days in New York, a caller threatened to harm hundreds of students in an Islamic school. In Texas, a mosque was firebombed. In Wyoming, an angry group of shoppers chased a woman and her children from a Walmart. In Bridgeview, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, police stopped 300 marchers as they tried to march on a mosque. Around the nation, Muslim and Arab communities say they are being targeted, and the anger is nationwide. India said yesterday it's asked the United States to take steps to prevent attacks on Sikhs living in the United States after last week's attacks on Washington and New York.
The trail is dusty, my road might be rough, but the better road's waiting, and boys, it ain't far off.
Trails of trouble, roads of battle, paths of victory, we shall walk.
I walked down by the river, I turned my head up high, I saw the silver lining hanging in the sky.
Trails of trouble, roads of battle, paths of victory we shall walk.
That evening train was a-rolling, the humming of the wheels. My eyes saw a better day as I looked across the field.
Trails of trouble, roads of battle, paths of victory.
You are listening to Ground Zero Radio, Democracy Now in Exile. I am Amy Goodman. That was Paths of Victory, the Broadside Singers with David Cohen and Pete Seeger. This is a piece by Robert Fisk from the 1998 issue of The Nation magazine, as he begins, "The last time I saw Osama bin Laden was in a tent on a mountaintop camp in Afghanistan last year. A few meters away was a 25-foot-high air raid shelter cut into the rock, a relic of bin Laden's days fighting the Soviet army, but bomb-proof against even a cruise missile. Bin Laden had entered the tent in his white Saudi robes, shaken hands with me, and sat cross-legged on the rug." Robert Fisk joins us now from Beirut. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Robert.
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. So tell us about that meeting you had with him.
Yeah, well, the meeting was for my own newspaper, the London Independent, not for The Nation, though I did write a piece for The Nation. Looking back on it, I suppose it was a prescient meeting, although at the time, of course, it was interesting enough. We knew that the Americans were fingering bin Laden as the man behind the attacks on American troops in the Gulf. We knew that bin Laden was being accused of running an international network of World Terror Inc., as the sobriquet went from the State Department and, of course, Time magazine. And it was a strange meeting in that it took me hours to get up this mountainside with guards, his armed guards, up a road which he himself had built with his own construction equipment during the Afghan-Russian war, so the Mujahideen could get up the mountainsides and could physically get high enough to fire British blowpipe missiles at Russian MiG fighters. It was a journey. The clouds were below us. There were waterfalls frozen above us. The Toyota Jeep screeching on the scree on the side of the mountainside. I at one point I thought we were in great danger of not surviving this. At one point, in fact, the driver, who was a Tunisian fighter for bin Laden, turned and said, "Toyota is good for jihad." In other words, Toyotas were good for holy war. But anyway, we got up the top of the mountain, and I was taken to a tent next to the air raid shelter. And I waited in there, and after about an hour, bin Laden walked in very humble white Saudi robes. I noticed on the latest videotape he's wearing some kind of gold-embroidered gold cloth, which seems to me as if something's changed in him, but anyway, in those days he was still the same. He had a slight infirmity in the leg, a kind of gave him a small limp, but I still have my notes scribbled in the frozen darkness with an oil lamp sputtering between us. And I've got the quotes which I thought were most frightening. He started off with the old cliche, "I'm not against the American people, only their government." Decades of dictatorship out here, of course, have persuaded many Muslims of the region that governments don't represent their people. And I tried to explain to bin Laden that this was not so in the West, that the American people, against whom he supposedly had no argument, regarded their government as their elected representatives. He didn't say much to this, merely the observation that we are still at the beginning of our military action against the American forces. He was talking there about American forces in the Gulf, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and so on. And then later on, there was a much more disturbing remark, or certainly disturbing in the light of what happened last week, and this does not mean he was responsible, but it obviously raises the question in my mind. He said, "We believe that God used our holy war in Afghanistan to destroy the Russian army and the Soviet Union." He said, "We did this from the top of the very mountain on which you are sitting, Mr. Robert, and now we ask God to use us one more time to do the same to America, to make it a shadow of itself. We also believe that our battle against America is much simpler than our battle against the Russians." And he went on to say that the reason for this was that some of his men had fought the Americans in Somalia. He meant the doomed UN mission to Somalia. And he said that that gave them the impression that, that he said, our men were surprised at the collapse of American morale in Somalia. This convinced us that the Americans are a paper tiger. Well, in the coming days, weeks, or months, he may change that view of the Americans being a paper tiger, but that's what he said to me at the time.
This is Robert Fisk describing his interview with Osama bin Laden. And this was in, when, 1997?
March the 26th, 1997 is the date on my notes.
Mm-hmm. And how difficult was it to make contact with him and to reach him?
Well, you have to understand, it wasn't that simple. I had first met him in Sudan in 1994, when he was already being fingered by the United States, but not for anything particularly specific. And at the time, he was using his own road construction equipment, the same bulldozers and earth movers he'd had in Afghanistan, to build a road for a small village, which would connect that village to the main highway between Port Sudan and Khartoum. And when I arrived, there were sort of festivities going on, and villagers were dancing and slaughtering sheep in his honor. And when I approached him, I think he thought I was going to ask him about World Terror, Inc. But in fact, I was more interested in hearing about his life. This, of course, is 1994 we're talking about, his life when he was fighting the Russians. He was wounded six times. He was undoubtedly a brave man at war. He didn't really want to talk about himself, but I pushed him, and he did. And he talked about how one day, in an attack on a Russian firebase in Nangarhar province, that's around the area of Jalalabad in southeastern Afghanistan, a shell, probably a mortar shell from the Russians, landed at his feet. And in the few milliseconds he waited to die, he said he felt this great tranquility come over him, a great calmness of spirit, which he associated with his religion. And then, no doubt the Americans today would wish it otherwise, the shell did not explode. But it obviously was a considerable religious experience for him, and I was interested to see what was making him what he was, and I think the war did it. There's no doubt. You've just heard the quotation from him about how he moved from the war against the Russians, whom, of course, he regarded as a corrupt Western power, from the Saudi-Afghan point of view, that's what they were, to the war against America. And anyway, I know that he secured a copy of the newspaper later on, and apparently he thought it was fair. He expected it was all going to be about World Terror, Inc. And so later, when I was in Afghanistan, I was able to make contact, and after many weeks, I received a boy came to a hotel in a ruined city and said to me, Mr. Osama, we'll see you. I was then told to be ready the next day when someone rattled a car key on my bedroom window, and I was taken out to a road where six young men, not that young actually, with rocket launchers and rifles were sitting on an open-top truck. I was a bit worried there might be Pakistani security or intelligence officer. This was inside Afghanistan, of course. And they took me off across the across wastelands. We went through an extraordinary, we must have gone hundreds of miles through deserted areas. There were whole Afghan villages bombed to pieces by the Russians, burned out tanks, naked babies playing in the ruins. A huge number of areas which no one went into because of mines. There are 10 million mines in Afghanistan today. 10 million. That's a tenth of all the world's mines. Mr. Bush will no doubt be thinking of that if he sends his soldiers in there. And eventually, in the evening, we came across a sort of orchard and a small stream, and I waded through the stream to the other side. And out of a mud hut with a lamp burning in it came bin Laden. And he said, how was I? And I said, I've come a long way. And he said, well, I've come a long way too. He'd obviously been traveling from the far end of Afghanistan to meet me. And there we had another conversation which very much revolved around his desire to destroy the Arab pro-American regimes, not the countries, but the regimes. First and foremost, the Saudi regime, which he regarded as corrupt. At one point, he pulled out a little notebook and started reading off all the millions of dollars in statistics which he believed various Saudi princes had misappropriated from the people's money, of the people's money. And he then went on talking about Egypt and about Jordan, both of whom he saw as being basically pro-Western regimes whose governments repressed their own people with torture. He spoke very movingly, or at least I thought so at the time, of course I might not think so now, of the tens of thousands of children who were suffering under UN sanctions. There weren't as many dead then, of course, as there are now in Iraq. He hated Saddam and made that very clear to me. I tried to draw him a little bit on his past. All he could remember, he visited London once. He could remember as a little boy of five or six looking out the window of a hotel, no doubt a very luxurious hotel because his family are multi-billionaires, and seeing red London buses, but that was really the only contact he had left from the West that he chose to talk about. And he then talked over and over again about some bombs which had gone off in Al-Hubba, near Dhahran in Saudi Arabia, and in Riyadh. He admitted in the last conversation we had on the top of the mountain that he knew two of the men involved in the bombing in Al-Hubba, who had since been executed, beheaded by the Saudis. But he said, I didn't plan it. It wasn't my doing, although I wish I'd had the honor to participate. That's what he said.
The bombing of the U.S. military.
A bit chilling.
This is the bombing of the U.S. military.
Bombing U.S. military base in Riyadh and Dhahran, or the Al-Hubba area of Dhahran. Yeah, 24 Americans killed in the second, I think 19 in the first. Military, of course. At that time, of course, I was still talking to a man who was talking about combating military forces, not civilians. And I also have to add, I simply do not have any proof that he is behind the... I don't think atrocities are really good enough. I think the word is crimes against humanity, which took place in New York and Washington last week. I don't have the proof, but obviously I've been thinking a lot about it, going back through my notes and reading what he said, and that phrase, a shadow of itself about America. Somehow, if you think of that and you see the World Trade Center coming down and the buildings around it, it sort of comes together in a rather chilling way. But again, that's not evidence, that's not proof.
Well, Robert Fisk, you went to Al-Marj, Lebanon, and met the family of Ziad Jarrah, who died trying to destroy the White House. Can you talk about this trip that you've just written about in The Independent?
Yeah, well, Al-Marj is a sprawling, quite well-off village in the Bekaa Valley. It's a Sunni and Christian village. It's not Shiite. It's not associated with the Hezbollah or previous suicide bombings in Lebanon of any kind. His father agreed to see me, probably because there's some knowledge there that I wrote a book about Lebanon, which is a fairly sort of compassionate account of what happened to this country in the Civil War. And we sat for perhaps 2 hours, 2.5 hours in all. A very broken man. He'd had a heart surgery in February of this year. And he told me about a son who very definitely didn't appear to him to be an Islamist, or at least that's what he said. He said that he had a very normal life, that he'd gone off 5 years ago to a university in eastern Germany, the eastern part of the modern Germany, to study mechanical engineering, and then had moved to Bochum, Hamburg, to study aeronautical engineering. He wanted to be a pilot. The father regularly sent him quite large amounts of money. He bought a private home for himself in Germany. He had a girlfriend, a Turkish girlfriend called Aslo, whom he lived with in Germany. And he enjoyed nightclubs, and he drank alcohol. He came home, he would go out for a drink with friends. So this was not like the men around bin Laden, who would never dream of smoking, let alone touching alcohol, who would get out of their vehicles in minefields and pray five times a day, as I saw them do in front of me in Afghanistan. His girlfriend, 18 months ago, so his uncle, this is his uncle Jamal, who was sitting close to Samir, the father, told me, his girlfriend, 18 months ago, reported him missing and was worried that he had gone for 5 weeks to Afghanistan. And I understand, though the family did not admit this to me, that they contacted someone in Peshawar to try and get him out if he was there. The family now claim officially that, in fact, it turned out he said he was just changing universities from eastern Germany to Hamburg and hadn't been in touch during that period. Though I have to admit I find that very strange, since not to tell the girl you're living with for 5 weeks where you are when all you're doing is transferring from one academic institution to another seems very peculiar to me. The boy came home in February when the father, Ziad Jarrah, came home in February of this year when the father had his open heart surgery, and was with him every day in the hospital, fetching things, bringing things, looking after his mother and his two sisters. He was an only son, so he mattered a lot to the family and mattered a lot to the father, especially in this part of the world. He was the man who was going to carry on the father's name. His full name, you see, was Ziad Samir Jarrah, taking his father's name as his middle name, as many of us do in the West. Anyway, in the summer, when he was back in America, his girlfriend, Asla, said she wanted to come to Lebanon to meet his family, and he said he was too busy to come. He was very sorry, but the girl came on her own. She wanted to meet her future in-laws, which, again, I thought was strange. What young man in love with a young woman and was going to marry her would not want to travel with her on her first visit to meet her future family, her Lebanese side of her family, in other words, her future mother and father-in-law? 2 days before the planes were hijacked, Ziad Jarrah rang his father to thank him for a money order of $2,000, which Samir, the father, had sent him. I said to the father, that was a lot of money. He said, well, he had a girlfriend to look after, he had a house to look after in Germany, a private house, he had to look after his tuition fees. I obviously wondered whether that $2,000 was buying airline tickets. I asked what he was doing on a flight to California, and they said, oh, he must have been just a passenger. I said, did he tell you he was going to California? No, he did not. So I said, isn't that a bit strange? He rings you to thank you for the money, and he doesn't mention in 2 days' time he's going on a 2,000-mile, three, however the distance is across the States, journey. He's going, oh, he's going on holiday, traveling with friends, perhaps. Mohammed Atta, the Egyptian involved in one of the two planes, the pilot of one of the two planes that hit the World Trade Center, was at the same university at the same time with him. And we believe that the two other men, two of the three other men who were on this flight, which went to Pennsylvania and crashed in the ground, with apparently Ziad Jarrah at the controls, were also staying with him at one point in Germany. So very strong circumstantial evidence to suggest he was not just a passenger, not just a tourist or another hijacked passenger. Now, since then, I've understood from security sources here in Lebanon that he did, in fact, go to Afghanistan 18 months ago, just before he went to America, and spent 40 days there. And when he came back, his neighbors were surprised to see he had a beard. Now, I know no more than that, and the family, I have to say in fairness, say that that is not true, that he did not go to Afghanistan. They don't believe it. But the hole in the story, if you can use that phrase for me, is if he's one of bin Laden's men, how come the booze? How come the women? How come the nightclubs? It doesn't come in parallel with what I saw in Afghanistan. And I met a lot of bin Laden's fighters, Algerian GIA men, Egyptians, Syrians, Gulf Arabs, Palestinians. They would never have behaved like that. The only possible, I suppose, thought that would go through one's mind is that some kind of special dispensation was given on the grounds that you've got to seem like a Westerner if you behave like a very conservative Islamist. American intelligence operatives could start to get suspicious. Now, I don't know. That's purely a guess. I have the speculation. I have no knowledge of it. But clearly, there is a hole in the story there. It's inexplicable that one of bin Laden's men, if that's what he was, should be behaving like any ordinary Western man and breaking an awful lot of the rules of strict Islam.
Robert Fisk is our guest, speaking to us from Beirut, Lebanon, has just come from interviewing the family of Ziad Jarrah, who died trying to destroy the White House. His piece begins when Ziad Jarrah climbed aboard United Airlines Flight 93 from Newark to San Francisco. Was he planning to holiday in California or to destroy the White House? The United States says the latter. His family begs visitors and friends to believe in his innocence. His father, Samir, sat beside Robert Fisk yesterday afternoon and opened his palms in that gesture of innocence, which is also a form of special pleading, Robert Fisk writes. So you have him buying these air tickets for the Boeing 757 flight to California. The other three men have been named as hijackers of flight UA-93, Ahmed Al-Haznawi, Ahmed Al-Nami, and Saeed Al-Ghamdi. And if two of them live with Ziad in Germany, his guilt seemed even more certain, you write, when it was revealed that one of his fellow students was Mohammed Atta, the Egyptian-born pilot who crashed American Airlines flight AA-11 into the World Trade Center on Tuesday morning. At this point, you also describe the mosque in the village of his family.
Well, I've never seen such a massive mosque for such a small village, though I have to say that all the villagers said that he was never seen going there. He didn't pray five times a day. It's also a Christian village. I just noted because I thought that it was extraordinary that such a huge mosque should be there. I mean, it's a towering construction with two huge minarets, and we're talking about a village of maybe 3,000-4,000 people only. In not a wealthy part of the Bekaa, although the village itself has quite a lot of money. His father's well-educated. In fact, the family as a whole, cousins and uncles, speak, many of them, English with American accents. They've lived in the States. They're very westernized. They speak pretty good English, quite good anyway. So, again, the mosque doesn't cure the hole in the story, so to speak. I have to say that whether that money that the father sent, or which he thanked the father for 2 days before the hijackings, was used on air tickets, I don't know. But obviously, that was a question that came into my mind. If you remember the mobile phone calls, those terribly sad calls that were made from that flight before it crashed in Pennsylvania, one of the men who got through to his wife described the four men as having red headbands. Now, that is more like an Islamist hijack. But, you know, it comes back to the thing, why would a guy who has an attractive girlfriend who's going to marry, who enjoys nightclubs, who goes drinking, set off to kill himself and everyone on the plane? A person who enjoys the material things of life would not normally do that. But maybe there was something we don't know about the makeup of that person. Or